Okie dokie. Right, we're going to get started. So welcome to the last in our current series of Employment Law 101. For those of you that don't know me, I am not Peter Beastie today. He's my colleague, but I am squatting in his Zoom account for today. I'm Adrienne Hardy, a partner at MPM Legal, and we are a boutique employment and business immigration firm supporting businesses with all kinds of employee-related issues. Today's session is being recorded as always, and we will host our recordings on our website and on our Spotify channel. You can find those by searching for MPM Legal Employment Law 101, where all of our other episodes are there too. As always, we're happy to answer your questions, so please feel free to use the Q&A function. It's easier for us to manage the questions if you do that rather than the chat, but of course you can chat to us as well. We don't turn on cameras and we won't be asking you to speak, so feel free to type away or simply sit back, enjoy, sip your coffee, eat your croissant, other pastries available. I'm delighted to be joined today by my colleague Victoria Burnip, who heads up our business immigration team, together with Chris Gore, expat tax director, and James Smith, employer solutions associate director, both from RSM. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Morning.
Morning. All right. And our topic for today is another post-pandemic favourite. I wonder at what point, after how many years, that we'll stop talking about the pandemic. But here we go. We're going to be looking today about what you need to be aware of when you invite your overseas staff to visit the UK on business. So let's kick it off. What kind of trends are we seeing now that international travel is back on the cards, guys?
I guess the main thing is what is an overseas employee now has changed. During post-COVID, there's now a lot more UK employees actually working remotely overseas. And we're now recruiting employees to be remotely overseas. So it's just a lot different to what it was before. Before, it was always a short-term business visitor coming from one overseas entity coming to the UK, which was kind of more cleaner cut. But now with the new kind of modern world of remote working, it's what is an employee overseas now, I guess, is the main question.
And from an immigration perspective, I think I'm seeing more of those short-term visits that Chris mentioned. So since not so much pandemic-wise, but since Brexit, there's a lot more, shall we say, shoehorning of activities in the UK, work activities into the business visitor route when they don't necessarily fit. So we've got a lot of square pegs and some round holes, and what is and what isn't permitted.
Yeah, and I guess that conversation comes up when we talk to clients all the time. It's that I'm allowed 90 days for business visits, and people don't appreciate that business visits are different everywhere and what you're allowed to do. So they just presume anything is classed as a business visit and therefore it's okay.
Yeah, I think that's your tax rules are getting lodged in their brain there, Chris, and they just think they can come and do whatever they want as long as it's for a certain number of days.
Yeah, I mean, I see it quite often on when business visits, they say, oh, you know, we can come to the UK on a business visit for up to 6 months. And, you know, OK, that's what the rule actually says. But that's not the end of the story, is it, Vic? And we see this quite often where people see that as code for I can just come and work in the UK for 6 months.
Yeah, it's a difficult one. Lots of US people, I think, use that route quite a lot. And interestingly, you can come in and you're granted entry for up to 6 months, and in theory you can leave and then come back again for another 6 months. So it's not actually the 6 month in 12 months, which is a bit of a myth. But obviously the more you do it, the longer you're here. If you're practically living here because you've been here every day apart from one in 12 months, the border will pretty quickly conclude that actually you're de facto living and working in the UK without a visa, and you might not be let in. So it looks free and easy, but it's not necessarily the case, as is always the way with immigration. And I'm sure it's the same with tax.
We get the infamous, I'm allowed 183 days. Everyone relies on, oh, 183 days, it's all good. I'm gonna just come here and then go back home. But from a tax perspective, that typically does not work in that way. There's a lot more, which I'm sure we're gonna talk about too.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm guessing it's not just business travel, it's all days spent outside, is it, for the 183?
Yeah, your 183 days is days of presence. So you've got your work days, your weekends, your holidays.
And let's not start on counting days. That's a whole different webinar.
That whole other webinar. We'll schedule in for the next season then. So what do you guys want to kick off with? What sort of things people should be considering then when talking about having a visitor come to the UK from your perspective, from a tax perspective?
I guess the first thing that when we talk to clients is it's how many people aren't correctly tracking visitors. So the first thing would be to make sure visitors are tracked. So firstly, you know who's coming to the UK and when, how long for, preferably in advance. So if you know if the next visit might trip a day count, and then knowing where they're coming from, whether it's an overseas branch, whether it's a subsidiary, whether it's just a remote working employee coming in. I guess those are the starting points to think about. And fundamentally, whether you've got anything in place to protect you from a compliance perspective, because you could have compliance obligations from day one.
Yeah, sounds pretty similar to our world, actually, the world of immigration. I mean, I've started with some clients putting together business visitor policies and process flows just to get that, like you say, the advanced tracking of knowing what is permitted in advance and trying to get people to at least adhere to a process flow. Obviously, they can just ignore it, but actually having a process set up internally so that it's not just somebody landing at your London office and you weren't expecting them. Ideally, they've got notice and we know how long they're coming for and what they're going to be doing whilst they're here.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I talk to clients about when they come into the UK, about getting immigration advice in advance, and not necessarily to say anything untoward at the border, but just making sure that they're coached on what they should be saying at the border in case they say something silly, which isn't actually relevant to what they're doing, but they say something's going to get them into trouble unnecessarily.
Yeah, we've got kind of avoid the word, I'm coming here to work.
Yeah.
And I'm coming here for training, so don't like that either. And people do just say anything because they're knackered and they're getting off a flight. If it's a long haul.
Just articulation, making sure they're clear on what they're saying when they're going through. And I think the reference I say, avoid getting put in a pen, because I've seen so many people sort of sitting in a pen as I'm coming through customs, like, oh. And again, a lot of the time, just because they said the wrong thing and it wasn't even relevant to what they were coming to the UK to do.
And there are ways to sort of mitigate that, I think. I mean, we often do what's called a comfort letter, or I call it a comfort letter, where the UK company that's maybe hosting them, or they're going to be visiting, clearly sets out what they're going to be doing, who's funding it, that there's a return flight, that there's a plan in place, and it's not just coming here, opening the laptop and off they go. We find that's quite useful because they can just blearily, idly shove that letter at the border staff. And like you say, hopefully avoid the dreaded pen.
Just pick up on one thing there, that comfort letter. We so often see a disconnect between someone saying they're doing something from an immigration perspective and then from a tax perspective saying the opposite.
Okay.
So you have a comfort letter saying, I'm going to be working with the UK company. You could inadvertently be bringing the UK company compliance obligation, even though you're a foreign employee in this case.
That's really interesting. So what would you want us to say in our comfort letter then, James?
Based on my conversations, Victoria, I don't think there's anything that we can say that's not going to be okay for immigration and okay for taxes. If it's okay for me, it's not for you.
That should have been our headline line. Like, whatever we say you can do from an employment and immigration perspective, James and Chris will say it doesn't work for tax.
But I guess the important thing is, from a tax perspective, there's quite often an option out there to mitigate the reporting obligation or at least reduce the admin. So although it becomes a problem from a UK perspective, it doesn't have to result in an actual tax liability or an actual reporting if a company gets the right processes in place.
Okay.
So it's a problem, yes, but can it be mitigated quite often?
And what about employment rights, Adrienne?
Well, some of you may remember we did a whole session where we were joined by our colleagues from other European jurisdictions, from I think it was Germany and the Netherlands, where we talked very, very carefully about being mindful of where overseas jurisdictions will bite and vice versa. So, for example, you might say to one of your staff who is a UK employee, yeah, it's fine for you to go work from your Tuscan villa with it overlooking the pool rather than, you know, working in what is a very rainy UK at the moment. But there's always it's always worth remembering that statutory rights, i.e. those set down by law, will often override what's in the contract. And so it's really important just to be be thinking about that, and equally the other way. So if somebody is working a lot in the UK, they will be accruing statutory rights. So I'm talking about things like obviously unfair dismissal protection, which kicks in after 2 years. But before that, we're looking at things like sickness absence, holiday entitlement, all those types of things that are set down in the law. And it's very important to get ahead of the curve and be aware of them. And I think we were discussing this before and saying there's not an awful lot that you can do necessarily to avoid them if you're going to go with that working pattern. But it's sure as hell important to know about them in advance. And one of the examples I think that that you guys came up with was, you know, if you have take some kind of family leave in Scandinavia, it's extraordinarily generous and you could end up as an employer with quite a large bill. And nobody actually working because they're off on family leave. And likewise, we ran into it recently where an employee, UK employee, was based in the Netherlands and their sick pay is incredibly generous as well. So it's about being mindful of all of these risks so that you can think about it, hopefully before you agree if somebody can work overseas. But if unfortunately it's too late and the horse has already bolted, then being aware of it will just help some planning.
And Chris and James, what was your take on, I think you said you're seeing quite a lot of trends where people have got UK contracts, but they're not in the UK.
I mean, one of the ones, let's pretend it was a result of COVID, but we've had ones where they've been long term overseas. I mean, I've seen 20 years an employee sitting in France before on a UK employment contract paying UK tax and national insurance. So it's not uncommon. But if there was ever a problem with that employment contract, I imagine there'd be a lot of French involvement based on what the French rights may be over UK rights when it came to terminations and things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, trying to fire somebody who's based overseas, do get advice, first of all. But I mean, and I'm not even going to mention in detail about the need potentially to look into whether or not you are required to have a corporate entity when you've got people, you know, working longer term overseas. But that's something else to bear in mind. But from a tax perspective, surely if they're working like long term in other jurisdictions, they can't just pay tax in the UK, or can they?
No. And the trouble where you end up with when you've got sort of 10 years, 20 years, your statute for limitation in the UK, how far back you can go and get a repayment, may not match up with the overseas territory. So if you find out you've done it wrong too far down the line, you may have more years to declare in the overseas territory than you can claim back in the UK. But we're still seeing it now. People, when they're recruiting people overseas in the modern world, we just want to hire talent wherever it is. The first port of call will be a UK employment contract. Can I put them on the UK payroll is the next question. So it's.
I get asked that all the time, at which point I just go into a flat spin panic and go, oh, tax, something about tax. Please go and speak to your tax advisors because I haven't got a clue.
It's a common question we get from our payroll team. A client just said, we've got an employee in Spain, can they go on the UK payroll or wherever it may be? And it's like, well, let's have a conversation with the client and just talk them through what else they need to be thinking about. Because as you mentioned it earlier, depending on what the employee's doing, you've got the whole corporate presence and everything else going on in the local country once you start playing those games. So it can get very complicated very quickly.
So what are the main...
I was just going to say, looking at that cost perspective as well, if you're looking at someone outside the UK needing to be living in another country, having payroll obligations and things, but... you flick into social security is quite often the big one for a UK employer. You're sitting around 14%, call it, in the UK, but you flip to French social security and you could be tripling that. 30-something percent in Sweden, 20-something in Spain. So employers in the UK thinking, oh, they can live in France, that's all good, but 14% to 45% is a big jump in social security.
And then post-Brexit, you've got Victoria's problem. If that employee is a French national, Spanish national, wanting to come into the UK for a day to do some work with the UK team.
Yeah, it depends what they mean by work. And suddenly we find it's being reframed as, no, it's just a business visit, or they're gathering information for their employment overseas, which are permitted business activities. But yeah, you have to obviously be truthful about the real intentions behind coming to the UK.
But how does that impact their employment overseas when their employment overseas is actually for the UK employer?
what the immigration rules and the visitor rules.
Yeah, so if they've actually got a UK employer and they're sitting in Spain with that UK employer, does that impact what they can do when they come here?
It won't help them if they're I mean, I'm going to assume they're Spanish in this example as well, yes. Not UK nationals. I mean, I think what I would say is I would get advice from you guys, first of all, on the tax, because I'm sure there'd be potentially on PAYE and how that interrelates. But coming into the UK as a Spanish national, it doesn't help that they've got a relationship with the UK entity. The rules are written around the kinds of activities and not the kind of contractual relationship that you hold with your employer or your group of employers. So, yeah, it doesn't actually help. And I've anecdotally been hearing from clients that at the border, it's being enforced really vigorously. So going the other way, but UK nationals going into the EU, they are happily going for their 2-week holiday in Spain, then trying to do a visit in the EU. And when they're hitting the 90 days and 180 days, which is the limitation for UK nationals, they're getting stopped at the border and being sent back on the plane. So a bit like you guys, when you said, you know, the 183 days factors in all kinds of presence. You look at that when they're coming into the UK or whether they're entering the EU as well.
And that European tracking is getting tighter, isn't it, by all accounts?
Yeah, I certainly heard a whole bunch of people got turned away last month from a client of mine because they'd had their holidays, hadn't really thought about the fact that the time would be accumulated, weekends, like you said, James, and they thought they could visit, I think it was Germany, for a week, and couldn't do it. Couldn't go visit the client, couldn't do the project that they were intending to work on, had to just turn around. So, it has to be, as you said, going back to your original point, Chris, I think it has to be a certain amount of planning and monitoring and tracking of time spent and where it's been spent so you don't have a wasted journey and wasted plane travel and all the rest of it.
Because the one I've heard on Germany, is the certificate of coverage. If you don't have an A1, even if you're going for a short business trip, going into Germany without an A1 certificate for social security purposes can be a problem, and they can stop you from going in.
And is that something that's happened after Brexit, particularly?
I think the Germans have always just been a little bit tighter. There was a lot of talk around the Brexit area. And it sort of came out a bit more, but it's always been an area of concern for Germany because they're so, let's say, efficient at getting their A1s out of the payroll software, whereas we have to apply to HMRC. It's a lot more of a slower process for us, so we can't get them as quickly.
So I know we've talked about directors before, Chris. I mean, I'm going to say, from an immigration perspective, they can come in and have a board meeting, but what's the tax position? Is it the same or is it totally different?
No, so this is the fun one, isn't it? Because this is the real contrast where HMRC will say a director's duties in the UK can never be merely incidental, so it will always be a taxable work day. As soon as a director comes to the UK to perform a director's duty, it's taxable. However, the remuneration structured, anything, it will be a taxable work day in the UK.
Wow, yeah. So just setting foot in causes the... Go on, James.
I was just going to add in there that our double tax treaties, which a lot of people rely on, that when you do have a duty that is not incidental, a lot of people rely on the fact that the treaty with the other country will exempt that income in the UK. Pretty much all of the treaties will say that the UK has the right to tax the director duty as well.
After the employment article, there's a special article just for directors to make sure we catch them all.
No one escapes.
So you might get in from immigration, but from a tax perspective, if you're doing that director duty, then you're most likely going to have some form of tax obligation, probably connected to the UK company to start implementing the payrolls and things like that.
And the one I spoke to you with James about prior to this was the non-executive director, who may only have 10 days for the UK company living overseas, comes in getting a specific payment for that non-executive director role. Would you like to let them in as well, Victoria?
I'll let them in. But yeah, what am I causing in terms of a headache for you guys?
But it was just more, if they're getting paid specifically for attending a meeting from that UK company as a payment for that role, it was whether there was anything different in those situations.
Yeah, there are some limited exceptions for payments under the visitor route, but fundamentally and generally speaking, any pay should still be coming from the overseas entity. So it's, again, take our fictional Spanish individual coming in for a business visitor. They should not be receiving pay, because obviously pay tends to go hand in hand with work, which is not allowed under the visitor route.
All of these situations where we've got the remote workers will be paid solely from the UK business.
Yeah.
And again, that non-executive director will be paid from that UK business for that those duties.
I think it's a potential issue if there's regular pay, because as I've said to many people who ask me these questions, and I just, a bit like Adriana, go, oh, tax, go and speak to somebody else, I haven't got a clue. But we do know HMRC and the Home Office share data a lot of the time. And so you're potentially flagging up a problem if you've got, even if you can explain it and make it clear that they're not usually setting foot or working in the UK, but there's a UK contract and UK payroll. I think you're setting yourself up for a flag and therefore for a potential audit by the Home Office. And I don't know if it's the same for you guys with HMRC. You know, is that a risk that people face?
I had a very strange conversation with a client only yesterday that they'd submitted something to HMRC, but then the employee got a letter from HMRC saying you've been in the UK this number of days.
Okay.
And therefore you're now taxable. And we're still trying to understand how they got this information. The question was, had that come from the border authorities to say?
I think it must have done.
Wow. So we're now investigating it, but I've never seen them that joined up in the past, but the fact these letters are now apparently happening, there is a question out there.
Yeah, I mean...
Sorry, I was just going to throw in the other one, Companies House data. So often we speak to clients in Companies House, you look at the individual and you declare your residency, so where you're living,
yeah,
and your directorships. So you get the Home Office, Companies House, HMRC.
The data's out there.
The data's there.
So yeah. HMRC will comb Companies House for this info.
If I was HMRC, I would.
Well, it makes sense, doesn't it? Because that's a statutory reporting. And if that doesn't tie in with everything else, I guess it's making sure that everything's all linked up and it's all consistent. But if you've got residence on one document and a different residence at Companies House, that's not gonna put you in good form from the point of view of HMRC, is it?
And you tie in as well that when you submit documents to Companies House, you date them.
Right.
So you have a director that's dating something.
Yeah.
And then you've got a date of presence in the UK from an immigration perspective. You've got a seamless dot that says you're doing a director duty physically in the UK, unless you happen to be, I don't know, on a plane or you arrived in the afternoon, but signed it in the morning. But there's a link that's easily available.
Yeah.
You went on to step beyond me. I was just more thinking there's enough technology out there now for HMRC to get a list of what companies have got a director on their board that's got an overseas address. I'm going to start knocking on their door and seeing if they're reporting any UK days for that director.
Yeah,
it's interesting as well. And Adrienne, you've probably had the same questions, and maybe you guys have as well. But I always get asked, well, how will they know? And leaving aside the dates on Companies House, like if they're in a room in our office or in their hotel room, tapping away on their laptop, you know, how is anyone ever going to know? And I always say, well, they might do. You know, you could have an audit if you're in the office that day and the Home Office knock on the door and you're sitting there. I mean, take it to extremes, but you've got a little plaque with your name on it on a desk and, your lanyard for the UK office around your neck, and you're not actually supposed to be here working. You're onto some serious problems from a right to work perspective and a compliance perspective.
I guess magnified every time they come back to the UK, I guess, because they're going through the border again for another day.
Yeah, and it is, I mean, it is monitored. I was going to say tracked. I don't think it's necessarily tracked actively by the Home Office. Maybe HMRC are a bit more on their toes. But it is definitely monitored. And the more you come over and the more frequently and the longer you come over for, the less persuasive it is that you're gathering information for your employment overseas and more looking like you're actually working.
I mean, certainly what we've seen quite a lot of is people whose jobs are truly global. So they'll, you know, their job duties will be for their home country, but also for the UK company. And to that extent, they bob backwards and forwards, which, you know, I'm talking sort of Europeans in particular, whereas, you know, pre-Brexit, that was easy. It was, you know, they just came across under freedom of movement from an immigration perspective. It was fine. And, you know, the exit from the EU has put, like, slam the brakes on on this, what was the juggernaut of freedom of movement. And for a lot of people, then we've had to say, look, the safest thing is to get a proper skilled worker visa. So you might only come over a couple of days every week, but it's not worth running the gauntlet of saying that's a business visit. It really isn't, because if your global duties as set down in your employment contract or your job description, and just by your active participation across both jurisdictions, you're never going to make that fly as a business visit. So the safest thing is to have proper immigration in place. And the beauty with the skilled worker visa system at the moment, as opposed to the previous tier two, is there's no longer a limit on how long you can sponsor somebody as a skilled worker visa. Because whereas before, I think it was, 5 years, wasn't it?
Six years.
So after that, you kind of had to start again, have cooling off period. Whereas now you can have somebody renew their skilled worker visa, never have to worry about, you know, the fact that they're not going to qualify to get to the next step on the immigration ladder and go indefinite leave to remain. But it's just certainly from an immigration perspective, that's safest. As for the tax, let's just hit the panic button again, because I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, as you say, because skilled workers can also stay on overseas payroll.
Yeah.
And we see that quite a lot. So they're really being seconded, I guess, but we've got them a skilled worker visa, and the rules do permit you to stay on that US or European payroll. Does that fix anything or cause more headaches for the tax
situation? Theory, they may be on that overseas payroll, but depending on how big you are, there may well be a lovely transfer pricing document that tells you you will recharge those costs for that individual to the entities that are benefiting from the services. And then once that person's got an integral role within the UK business, that 183-day dream day count will drop straight down to 60 without even thinking about it. It could be lower. So right. the threshold before you hit a real taxable issue is lower, but the UK company will have a reporting obligation from day one potentially.
I'm glad I put in my advice email at the end of getting someone a visa. Please speak to your tax and payroll teams about what on earth you're going to do about any of this, because I've just got them the visa and I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah.
But we're saying there are a couple of options in place to try and reduce that tax obligation by making an application to HMRC, then doing annual reporting instead. But without that, HMRC would expect those days to be reported from the beginning.
And again, that comes back to planning, I guess, making sure you know what you're doing before you start doing it. So we're kind of already at the end of our session, believe it or not. Have you got any sort of top tips that you want to share with the listeners in terms of prepping for people coming to the UK from overseas to gather information or visit rather than work?
I think you have to track. You have to know when people are coming, how often. That's our biggest thing, and also what they're doing here. If you are genuinely coming in the UK to do something for your overseas employer, that's assuming you've got some form of subsidiary outside the UK or parent, understanding who the benefit of this work is going to be for. Are you working alongside the UK company or are you working for your home entity? If you're a remote worker for the UK, so you've got maybe a UK employment contract, but you live outside the UK, there's probably going to be something from day dot. Perhaps even some pre-travel planning. But definitely track, understand who is coming in, when they're coming in, how long for, and what they're doing.
And if you've got overseas presence or overseas, look at getting short-term business visitor agreements in place with HMRC to help mitigate your immediate reporting obligations.
Yeah, all good tips. So whilst the rules say yay for you and nay for me in some cases and vice versa, actually the prep work you would recommend is pretty similar to what we would recommend from an employment and immigration perspective. It's get your ducks in a row first. I would add to it and say, make sure they actually intend to return to their home country. So travel with a return flight, travel with evidence you've got some money, because that the one surefire way to get rejected at the border is not being able to demonstrate you can maintain yourself whilst you're here. But like you say, bit of planning and a bit of tracking, because you don't want someone to try and come into the UK and they find they've hit a limitation or they've been here too often for too long and they're not admitted to the country as well. So lots to think about.
And I'd just add that extra point on directors. If you have a director who is outside the UK who is coming in, they've got that heightened risk. I'd always look at a director from the first time they ever come to the UK in isolation to everyone else. So look at what they're doing. Anything to do with a statutory role, you're going to have something that needs to be done.
Even if they're not getting paid for that role specifically, HMRC will look at their global remuneration package and take a proportion of it based on UK days.
So treat directors as a special subcategory.
And plan for them. I once had a US director of a very big entity with a very small part in the UK, and they were a typical US director earning a very lot of money, and without the right planning, HMRC wanted a straight line apportionment of their UK compensation, a US compensation,
wow,
which was grossly unfair compared to the size of the UK business. So absolutely plan for those directors and what they're actually doing and how long for.
Yeah, because often in, well, certainly in UK employment contracts, where somebody is an exec director rather than a non-exec, you see it's commonplace to have a statement in there saying your salary includes any fees that you might have as a director. And I guess for overseas directors, that's just too woolly. That would properly expose them, wouldn't it, from the case that you've just talked about?
Yeah. I mean, this case was, I'm talking decent eight-figure US compensation.
Oh. Ouch.
For a very small UK entity, and if you straight-lined apportioned it, and if 5% was a chunky number, which was probably significantly more than the UK turnover.
I was going to say, wipe them out. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Don't bankrupt your small UK entity, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Okay.
Good to know. Yeah. Good to know.
But also, the directors, they're higher profile from the start, and we often see they need that little bit more care and attention as well.
Yeah.
Yeah,
brilliant. Okay, I'm going to have to call it a halt there because we've run out of time, but that's very interesting / very scary and very complicated. But anyway, look, thank you ever so much, everybody, for joining us today. I hope you've enjoyed our last session in this season. We'll be starting again in September for season 3. I know it sounds like some kind of Netflix series. We will be hosting some other webinars in coming months on specific topics, including an exciting look at how to avoid the spiral of grievances, managerial disputes, and so on by the use of early mediation. And that's going to give us a chance to introduce you to our new colleague, Michael Farrier, who is an accredited mediator and a very experienced employment lawyer. So keep an eye out for the alerter for those coming up. Spread the word to your colleagues. If they want to sign up, they can do it on our website. And that's everything that I've got for today. So thanks ever so much, everybody, and enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.